Welcome to another edition of Simons Says, a podcast devoted to conversationalists and the curious-minded. Here's your host, me, the follically challenged Dave Simons, certified financial planner and all-around nice guy. Hello again, everybody. So a number of years ago, I am driving around in my car, and I hear this talk show host. This is talk radio that I'm listening to. And he says something to the effect, and I'm paraphrasing here. He says, you know, all this talk about exercising, and you got to run 5 miles a day. Yeah, he sounded kind of angry about it. All this running and biking and swimming and going to the gym, you don't need to do any of that to be healthy. You don't have to exercise to live a long life. It's all about what you put into your body. That's what he was saying. It's all about keeping your calorie intake low. It's about what you eat. As he put it, it's not about what you do with your body. It's what you put into your body. And I admit, now this is like 15, 20 years ago. And I got this visceral reaction, like, this guy is the biggest idiot I've ever heard. Why am I listening to him? He doesn't know what he's talking about. He probably has no discipline in his life. He hates exercising, and now he's justifying his bad behavior. I was just convinced he knew nothing. Well, as I've said on these podcasts before, one of the beauties of getting older is we tend to get a little wiser, I think. We have more life experience. We see experience in other people. I'm not saying that I've come full circle and have done a 180, but let me just tell you, all these years later, as I've gotten older, he was on to something. Now, I would have never admitted that. I would have never known to have admitted that back then. As most of you know, if I have one addiction in my life, and it's still true to this day, is my exercise, my running, swimming, biking, going to the gym. And to me, that's always been the end all, because here's the deal. You could exercise away bad eating habits. My unprofessional opinion, that's the way I looked at it. So as long as I ran my 8 miles that morning, I could eat ice cream. I could go have a pizza. I could do whatever and stay in shape and stay fit. Well, it's not so easy anymore in my 60s. My metabolism has slowed, and I noticed that even with me still exercising a ton, I can't eat a ton, and I have to be more cognizant. So there are those two extremes, right, we're talking about. You could have someone who does no exercising at all but eats really well. I mean, seriously, no fast food, calorie intake, very regimented, all that. Or you could have the other extreme, which is exercising like a fiend, and you don't care what you eat. I would have said this was the way to go 20 years ago. If I had to pick any extreme, it would be more this. But we know the reality. It really should be in the middle, right? We should eat well. And if we're being honest, maybe even a little bit of exercise. It could be as little as 4 or 5 days a week, going out and walking briskly for 30 or 45 minutes. So it's somewhere in between is the perfect combination. But the point in this today's discussion is the nutritional side of things. I'm fascinated by this. This is such an interesting industry to me because it's somewhat connected to mine in financial services. We could have a goal. Let's keep it on the nutritional side and say, this is, I want to be in good shape and I want to eat right. And I've got these 27 books here behind me on how to do it. And in a way, it's the same with what I've seen in my industry, how to be successful in investing for retirement. And it's all about, you're overcomplicating it. It doesn't have to be that complex. But there's always the latest diet fad, right? I love looking at the New York Times bestseller list, and it's amazing to me how often I will look at any particular week, top 10, and three of them might be related to cookbooks or diets. All the time. They're always there. That shows you as a country how interested we are in it. But is it too much? And shouldn't we keep this simple? Is it as simple as eat your fruits and vegetables, just like we were told as little kids, right? Keep your calorie intake to a certain degree, and that's it. So to find out the answers to all of that and more, we are going to bring in a professional, Jennifer McDaniel. I've known Jen probably close to about 15 years or so. The first time I met her, she was actually brought in to speak and to help along this marathon group that I was starting in back in the 2000s or so. And then I ended up hiring Jen one-on-one personally when I did my Ironman in 2015. I really needed to zero in on the proper nutrition that an Ironman training regimen really needed. So I thought there's no better person to bring in than Jen McDaniel. So without further ado, my guest on today's or this week's version of the Simon Says podcast is Jen McDaniel. Jen, welcome.
It is a pleasure to be here. What a nice introduction.
Well, it only took about 10 minutes to get you there, but well, you stayed in your seat the whole time.
Yes,
so
good listener.
McDaniel Nutrition Therapy. First of all, I love that name, by the way, Nutrition Therapy.
Yes.
Did you come up with that right away, or did you have another name when you first started, or what?
Well, there's a term called medical nutrition therapy that exists. And that is when dietitians work with a client such as yours and maybe an area of chronic disease management like diabetes or heart disease. And so when we work with a client, that's called medical nutrition therapy, MNT, right? And I was trying to come up with our company's name, it is very difficult to find a unique health and wellness name that's not already taken. So McDaniel was my last name.
Yep.
And nutrition therapy, you know, it just kind of came together as MNT. So I have my own MNT company delivering medical nutrition therapy.
Some of you in St. Louis might recognize Jen here because you make a lot of TV appearances too. So when the go-to person is needed for anything to do with nutrition and eating well, they bring in Jen McDaniel. You also have a number of acronyms at the end, and I look at that. I'm not going to try to figure it out, but give us your bona fides. What are your degrees, your licenses, and those acronyms? What are they?
So RD is registered dietitian, and that's an important one because a lot of people can call themselves a nutritionist, right? And a lot of people have probably worked very hard to call themselves that. But a nutritionist has no standard traditional educational definition, right? So it's not really a credential. So it's important that if we've gone through as a dietitian and done the bachelor's degree and done the internship and taken the exam and kept all of the credibility stuff that you have to keep up with, that's the RD credential. And then I'm licensed in the state of Missouri and hopefully here in Illinois pretty soon. I just submitted all my applications for that. Mm-hmm. And then CSSD stands for Certified Sports Dietitian, basically. It's a long name, but yes. So those are my, and then my master's degree is MS. So.
Holy cow. When's the PhD coming?
I'm done.
No, you're done.
I'm so
done. I don't blame you. You know, when I look at your website and I see some of the people who work with you and for you.
Yes.
And one thing that jumped out at me, because these are the kinds of stuff that I find fascinating. So I went to other nutritionist sites and I saw the same thing. Mm-hmm. This is a female-driven industry for the most part. That doesn't mean anything in particular, mm-hmm. but I'm curious about that. Why in the field of nutrition does it seem to attract more women to be professionals than men? Any idea?
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, we are seeing a change in that. You know, we're seeing a lot more men. And I've actually interviewed a lot of men for our own company. I've got a mastermind group of great, like two men that are just movers and shakers within the industry. But, you know, it is like a self-interest, caretaking, also sort of health behavior change industry. And I think women by nature tend to fall into those characteristics. But women, you know, we have a history of women being the ones to feed the families too. So there's that.
Good point. And women, dare we say, tend to be more body image conscious. And part of that is just our society as someone who's got an adult daughter now, someone who's married, I cringe at that a little bit in today's society, the kind of perfect model of a woman that we put on the magazine covers. And so these are the diets that you have to get there. This is the kind of exercise. And I think women plug into that healthy-wise and not so healthy-wise too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, culture has been, you know, awarding women for being not very much of them, right? Mm-hmm. Skinnier is better. And we know that women are rejecting that now. And they're recognizing the fact that it is important to be strong. It is important to be fit, but it is not important to necessarily be a thin body weight. And so we are seeing a beautiful movement of things like intuitive eating, which rely more on a woman's and a man's, you know, internal wisdom about how they eat versus going into the diet culture and feeling like they have to eat by a set of rules in order to be a certain way. And that is really fun to reject as a dietitian.
You know, you're touching on something that I think is fascinating, and it can be difficult to talk about. I got to phrase this right, because I think people might hear this in the wrong way, that we do have an obesity epidemic here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. That is factual. But there, I think we try to simplify it a little bit. Well, it's lack of discipline. Well, maybe in some cases, it's always been that. But maybe it's also the fact, the way that we produce our foods. It's also, I think we've gone to also, and you were sort of touching on this, accepting of different body types, where some people are going, well, have we gone too far though, in that we're almost promoting it and we're celebrating? I'm going to put that part of it aside, and I'm going to come back to a little bit of the way that we process foods today. You've been in the business a long time, even though you're only like 28 years old.
Right, yeah.
But I would like you to address that, in that, is there some kind, have the food companies figured this out to say, look, if we put this into the foods, the human brain gets addicted to this, and we can sell more of that product. I don't want to be conspiratorial, but I think at the same time, there's got to be some truth to that. To see what has happened in this country over the last few decades is not an accident, and it's got to be the food sources to a certain degree, is it not?
Yes. I mean, I'm 46. Oh, 45, actually. My husband is... Anyway, you
He's
forget when you get older, don't you?
Oh my gosh. Well, I'm not trying to flatter you here, but I'm going to anyway. I didn't know how old you were until you just said
that.
Yeah. That blows me away.
I'm halfway to 90. And
wow.
And I grew up with a parent who followed the low-fat diet. It was like the Snackwells craze. When I would open my pantry as a little girl, it was all the green boxes.
Yes.
You know, of the fat-free products. And that's when I think we saw a decrease in fat. We saw a really big increase in added sugars because we didn't think high carb was a problem. And so we see these swings, and we see the food systems respond. But when we look at the data, about 60% of what Americans eat is what we consider ultra-processed food. Now, I won't get into the weeds with this. I don't actually agree with all of the definitions of ultra-processed. So for example, tofu, I eat a lot of plants, and one of my plants that I eat is tofu, and I love it. And that's actually considered an ultra-processed food, which I disagree with that definition. When I think of ultra-processed foods, I would think of Oreos and Doritos, all the foods that my kids love to eat too. But 60% of our diet is made up of ultra-processed food. So what that means is we're eating a lot less of what you said in the very beginning, fruits and vegetables and beans and nuts and whole grains. And we have become more reliant on the convenience of those ultra-processed foods. And there's no, I think that there's a blame on the food industry for sure. I also think we need to work with the food industry instead of just demonizing them and saying they're all bad and whatever. We need to work with them and help them and buy the foods, because there's, you know, one company could have a very good healthy product. So for instance, I mean, I have Kashi whole grain cereal every morning. It's got 4 or 5 grams of fiber per serving. And then, you know, the same company is also making a very high added sugar cereal. So, but it also comes to what can we afford? So there's so many things that go into one's food choices, and the environment very much shapes that. You know, what we have access to, what can we afford, where do we live, how easy is it for us to move our bodies in the communities that we live in, what kind of jobs do we have that we have to sit and be in front of a Zoom computer all day long. So there's lots of things that influence the shape, the size, the health of our bodies, and it's societal. It's also personal choice.
I mean, it is complex, isn't it?
It's so complex.
One of the things that I said at the beginning was we tend to overcomplicate things, so I want to touch on that. While there's so many inputs into this, it really is somewhat simple at the same time. There's a little bit of a dichotomy to say, look, have your fruits, have your vegetables, as you said, nuts, beans, things like that. Why is that so difficult, though, for the average person to look at that and go, yeah, I believe that, but it's really hard to do?
Again, that's also complex. It could be that they have a bar that they feel like, in order to eat those foods, I have to make this complex meal, right? I have to cook and like plan and all these recipes. That is true. You cannot eat a healthy diet if you're not planning and doing some kind of cooking in the kitchen, right? You can't really get away with that.
Or it's expensive. You could do that prepackaged, mm-hmm. but you've got to go to a high-end grocery store and pay a lot of money for it.
Totally. Yeah. So there's that. They could have, you know, maybe they were raised as children on a certain way of eating. And so their view of what is comforting to them are those Pop-Tarts or the ice cream or whatever, you know, food is comfort. That's how they deal. That's how they feel better. So that could be one reason. Maybe they're feeding a family of five. And, you know, I know when it was just my husband and I, when my kids were at camp, we were able to eat so much healthier. And then when my kids came back, it was like I felt the need to be able to have, you know, exposing them to all different types of foods. Because if you give kids only one type of food and you can't have Pop-Tarts, you can't have ice cream, they're going to go to their friend's house and they're going to have a party over there, right? And they're going to have an unhealthy relationship with food. So as a parent, it's my job to be able to give them, you know, a balanced approach. And so that means we have to have some of those things in the house. And then therefore, it makes it a little bit, you know, perhaps less healthy for my husband and I too. So there's lots and lots of influences. So when someone comes in and works with a registered dietitian, it's our job to kind of excavate that, to help understand what drives you and your food choices and how can we work with you very individually, because it's not a one size fits all plan.
So you almost have to have an honorary counseling degree on your wall too, right? Seriously, that's a big part of it. You're saying that you have to dig into what makes these folks tick. What are their hot buttons? What are the walls that they may not even realize that they have put up, which prevents them from trying to become more holistic in their food choices? Mm-hmm. That's got to be a tough job for you.
I enjoy that part, though. I really do. I get kind of bored when someone just says, should I have like this salad or this salad? You know, like I like talking about the stuff that goes deeper than that. And in the beginning, with most clients, I do ask them, what was it like as a kid in your home when you were eating? Did your parents make you finish everything on your plate? You know, did they make you sit there until you were done? Or were you in a household where no one ever sat down as a family and everybody was just kind of doing their own thing? Like, let's understand what it was like for you, because that shapes who we are today and how we interact with food and how we interact with our bodies.
I think one of the tough things for you in your industry, I would imagine, is I had mentioned all these books, all these opinions. And in today's world that we can all go online and we can look at it and say, okay, how do I lose 23 pounds? How do I eat right? And you're going to be flooded with all kinds of different opinions. How do you sort through all that, especially if someone else who's very sure of themselves comes in and says, well, I don't know, Jen, if that will work. I read this diet. I have a friend who was on this diet and she's lost all this weight and looks great. Mm-hmm. And you look at them and say, what?
I mean, first and foremost, I respect what they have come in with their knowledge, because something has resonated with them. And if something's resonated with them, then we kind of figure out, what is that? What about that feels right for you? Now, I also have people who have come in who have tried lots and lots of different things and not had very long-term success with those things. So we might take a look and be like, well, how has that approach worked for you over time? To try something for a couple of weeks, to get bored with it, to feel like it's too restrictive. And so really helping them to connect with what is the most sustainable, the most enjoyable, the most simple approach for you. And I don't come in thinking I've got all the right answers, because we are unique. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we do genetic testing in our private practice. And so something is that's part of understanding we have a unique genetic makeup. We have unique upbringings. We have unique ways that we respond to certain nutrients. So my job is to first and foremost respect the person that's coming in, hear them, listen to them, and then help guide them along to the plan that comes along with my evidence base, because we have to bring in the evidence. And if someone says, oh, keto's right for everyone, that's not been shown to be true in the evidence. And so I always like to bring it back to what does the body of research over many, many, many years, not just the latest study, have to tell us? So I bring in my understanding of research, their personal experiences, and then we come together on what's the best fit for them.
I want to explore this thing that you just mentioned about the genetic testing. I'm really fascinated by that. I didn't realize that that's also now part of the process. I can't imagine that that was a big thing 30 years ago. Perhaps we didn't have the science or technology outside of maybe going to the doctors or hospital to get that done. So someone comes and works with you or some other dietitian or nutritionist. What are you looking for? First of all, tell me about how does the testing work? Tell me about that process and what the ultimate goal of that is.
So first and foremost, the genetic traits that we are looking at are health and wellness traits. These are not diagnostic traits that you would look at, like, are you going to get breast cancer? Are you going to get Alzheimer's?
Are you going to be bald?
No, that's not one of the traits that we look at. But we look at things like, are you or someone who does better on a slightly higher carbohydrate plan for body composition, or do you do better on like a higher fat, lower fat plan? So we can look at things like that. We can look at things like, are you someone who tends to have normal vitamin D levels, or is it harder for you from a genetic standpoint to raise your vitamin D? We can look at exercise traits, such as if you're, you know, trying to change body fat, increase muscle mass, is that more efficient for you from a cardio standpoint or a strength training standpoint? So we've got about 30 different traits that we look at in our personalized genetic test. And then that helps us to just move the needle in personalization. But what it really does, I think, for our clients is gives them the confidence, because as you mentioned earlier, the 30 different diet books sitting behind them, this allows them to kind of mute those out, tone those down a little bit, and then focus on their genetics, focus on what is true for them from that piece of the puzzle of their health. So the way that the test works is it's just a saliva swab, and then we ship it off to the lab in Chicago, and then they analyze it in about 3 to 4 weeks. We have, you know, a 77-page report that goes over all of their genetics. And the most important piece of that, though, is we have the health practitioner there to interpret the data. And that's some of the problem with, like, genetic testing today. You know, when I did mine maybe like 6 or 7 years ago, it was 23andMe.
Yep.
And it was great. I got so much information, but there was no one there on the other side of the table to review what that meant for me.
Right.
And what we've seen with some people is when they just get data, that almost makes them more anxiety, you know, anxious about what their genetics have shown, because there's no one there to help show them, okay, now that we know this about you, here's some strategies that we can use to support that genetic finding.
This is really, I'm learning so much myself here. I think this is such a big breakthrough. And I really hope people who may have been on a lot of kinds of diets and things and have struggled are really hearing what Jen is having to say here, because I think you just hit on it. Why my friend has done really well in this diet plan that she's on. I tried it and I gave up after 3 weeks because I felt nauseous or it wasn't helping. Mm-hmm. And I tried this and it doesn't work. And what you're saying is it's not necessarily a discipline thing. It's not that you're doing anything wrong. It's your genetic makeup. To add that into the mix, I think, is so key. And I notice that even with my training group, where some of us can eat ice cream every day as they've gotten older and their metabolism has just stayed really high, where others, it's like, ooh, no, I may exercise 20 hours a week, but boy, I balloon out.
Yeah.
And it's because you don't pick your parents, right? But that's a big key in this.
It's a key. I'm not going to say it's a big key because I really don't want to overinflate genetic testing.
Okay.
I want to say that if I got a big puzzle, a 50-piece puzzle, that's not a big one, a 500-piece puzzle, you know, maybe 100 pieces of those puzzle is dictating part of our health, right? So how we move, how we eat, how we manage stress, how we, you know, there's a lot of other things that dictate our health outside of genetics, but it is an important key.
Mm-hmm.
And it is something that just gives people that extra piece of knowledge about themselves that, you know, they wouldn't have had beforehand.
Right.
There is something I just want to mention, the world of epigenetics. So epigenetics is whether or not the gene that we know, so your genes are your genes, like what you just said, what you're born with from mom and dad is what you will leave this earth with. But whether or not the gene is turned on or off is, and that's kind of very simplifying the process, but that's epigenetics. So we don't really know that. So sometimes people will say things like, for instance, I'll use the caffeine gene. The caffeine gene is a really cool one. If you're a slow metabolizer of caffeine, then caffeine really impacts you. It stays in your system a lot longer. It can increase blood pressure. I'm a slow metabolizer of caffeine, so I had to cut back on my morning dosage because one study from the American Journal of Medicine showed if people drink 200 to 300 milligrams of caffeine, which is about 2 to 3 cups of coffee, that increased their risk of a non-fatal heart attack by about 36%.
Wow.
So it's a meaningful gene. But some people will say, well, I don't notice that at all. I mean, I can drink a cup of espresso at 9 o'clock at night and fall asleep just fine. It's possible that gene is not just being turned on. So there are things that we are continuing to learn as we do genetic testing, but I felt so strongly about the fact that this really is an important piece of the puzzle that my clients deserve to know about. So that's why we integrated it into the company.
Yeah, it's funny. My wife, if she drinks coffee after noon, she doesn't fall asleep at 10.
It's crazy.
That's fascinating to me.
Yes, that's genetically driven
yeah,
for sure.
I don't drink coffee at night because I may feel it, but a lot of times I will have one in the middle of the day, 3 o'clock, just to kind of get through. I'm starting to, you know, get a little sluggish.
Yep.
It doesn't impact me at all. I have a friend, you kind of described this person, they could literally walk to bed sipping their coffee, put it down, and go right out.
Yes.
That fascinates me.
I know. I'm kind of jealous of those people,
actually. Yeah, you know, because I like my coffee, right?
Yeah,
let's
me
talk.
Too.
I want some practical things for our viewers and listeners coming out of this when it comes to the foods that we put in our body.
Mm, great.
So, things like we talked about fruits and vegetables. Mm-hmm. I know that the answer to this question, are they all made the same? Of course not. But when I talk about like superfoods, mm-hmm. you had mentioned to me when we were talking like a week or so ago, because I said, what about superfoods? And is that something that's just a marketing thing? And you said something interesting. Fruits and vegetables, those are kind of our superfoods.
Yes.
Right? Are those the two most important things? When we really just narrow it down simplistically, if we're getting our fruits and vegetables, that's more than half the battle. Explore that.
Well, so I have to go to our gut, our intestine, right? That is where we have what is called our microbiome. We are made up of trillions of bacteria, and we're actually more bacteria than we are human. Crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And so the health, we're learning about the microbiome, and you probably, our listeners have also probably heard about microbiome testing, right? Stool testing, where they have, you know, you poop, you test it, and you see what types of bacteria are in there. And we know that when people have lots of different types of bacteria and an abundance of them, so variety and abundance, that quite often that leads to much better health. So our gut microbiomes are responsible for our immunity. They're responsible for our mood. They're responsible for our cardiovascular disease so much. And the food that those good bacteria enjoy is fiber. So it's not just fruits and vegetables, but it's things like beans and nuts and seeds and avocado and all of those things that provide the body some fibers. And we want to get a variety of fibers. And there's this one project called the American Microbiome Gut Project. And so they've looked at lots and lots of different people's fecal tests. And they've identified that if people were eating 10 different plants a day, which is a lot for some people, mm-hmm. we can count on your little food journal how many different plants you ate. But this also includes whole grains, right? So oats and whole grain pasta and those sorts of things. If they're eating at least 10 different plants in a day, they had much healthier body weights and healthier overall outcomes. So I push the plants. I push the different types of fibers, the antioxidants that come with all of those colorful, you know, fruits and vegetables. And I also push all different forms. You don't just have to eat fresh. Frozen is my favorite place in the grocery store because you can get so many different types of plants that are already sort of pre-prepped for you. And you keep them in your freezer and then you only have to use what you need.
Right.
You know, they don't go bad. They're more inexpensive. So I love all plants for our health. And I love all different forms.
You told me, this is very hard for me to say because I can't stand this. Even hard for me to say the word because I start to feel nauseous.
Uh-oh.
Mushrooms.
Oh, yeah.
You said that's the big mama for you right there in terms of food products, right?
There are a lot. I won't just say mushrooms are the only one. I think I was mentioning a seminar that I did with a corporation, and we were talking about undervalued plants, right? Mm-hmm. Like celery and beans and mushrooms, things that you don't see fancy commercials for, right? But mushrooms, yeah, I mean, they have all sorts of nutrients in there, but they have one called beta-glucans, which you can also find in oats, which are wonderful for reducing cholesterol, and they have great antioxidant power. So yeah, I try to have mushrooms. You know, we had some on a kebab on Sunday. So mm-hmm. Yeah, grilled some of those things.
Yeah, my wife loves it when we have something that has mushrooms because she gets double the dose. Because it's like, well, Dave's not going to have the much. Right. So we love kebabs too.
Yeah.
But she'll get, with all the veggies, which is great,
yeah.
But you got to get these proverbial mushrooms. And I almost look at the piece of meat. Did a mushroom touch this piece of meat? Get that off there. Well, I don't know what it is. Is it the texture? Is it something?
The concept.
Did I get sick as a kid eating? Yeah. I don't know. But I just, that, by the way, I only dislike two food things.
It's
really
pretty good.
I can eat everything. The problem is the two things are really popular.
What's the other one?
And they're in a lot of things, so it seems like I don't like a lot of mm-hmm. things. Mushrooms and mayonnaise.
Oh, man. Well, you can live without mayonnaise.
I know. And I don't, again, why don't I like mayonnaise? I like sour cream. Fine. I don't use mm-hmm. much of it. I don't have a problem with sour cream. Mm-hmm. Blue cheese dressing. I don't really use it, but I don't mind it. But mayonnaise, it's the weirdest thing.
That's okay. And I think something else that's just important to bring from your example is that you don't have to eat every single food to be healthy, mm-hmm. right?
Right?
I mean, just you can live without mushrooms and mayonnaise for sure and still have a pillar of health over there.
What about red meat? That's a big controversy. There are some diets that are just like, it's 100% meat. Other people say, well, watch it because it's got all these other bad things into it. What does Jen McDaniel say about our intake of mm-hmm. meat?
So I like to come back to the most evidence-based diet, like patterns, dietary patterns that exist. And one of those is one that I have a cookbook on from the Mediterranean diet. So in the Mediterranean, they're talking about all meat, but mostly red meat. So if you look at the Mediterranean pyramid, you'll see red meat at the top, which means sparingly, mm-hmm. right? And then underneath that, you'll see chicken and the dairy. And then underneath that, you'll see the fish, meaning more fish, a little less chicken, a little less red meat. And so the reason for that is that we do see a relationship between certain types of processed meats, for instance, deli meats and, you know, bacon and sausages and red meat that are more correlated with heart disease and the saturated fat. But that does not mean that you cannot have a serving or two of red meat a week. And also the thing with the Mediterranean diet is even if they had meat every day, it was just a smaller quantity. It wasn't the center of the plate. Like when you go to Omaha Steakhouse or Ruth Chris, it's the main attraction,
yes.
right? And so what we're trying to do is have it a little bit more of the condiment approach, you know,
uh-huh.
So it's just a little less. So if you were having a kebab, that'd be a beautiful way to have a couple pieces of red meat along with all of your vegetables. And then you're getting, you know, what you want, but you're also getting some of the other things that help with, you know, like cancer prevention with all the vegetables. And it comes down to the cut of the meat too. You know, mm-hmm. some cuts are just going to have more fat than others.
Right.
But red meat also has a lot of redeeming qualities, right? It's rich in iron. It's rich in all of these minerals and vitamins that are wonderful for us. So it's not an all or nothing approach. It's just that it shouldn't be the center of our plates multiple times a week.
There are people watching this right now, and I know that you will have clients who are vegetarian.
Mm-hmm.
So the red meat, any meat mm-hmm. is not a big deal. Is it possible to take the good parts of what we get in meat, even things like salmon, very healthy protein, you know, mm-hmm. meat-based food,
mm-hmm.
chicken, things like that, to be a vegetarian and be as healthy as you otherwise would?
So the question is, can you be a healthy vegetarian and get all the nutrients that
Correct.
You can in meat?
Yes.
Now, it does have, you do have to work a little harder at it.
Sure.
Right. You do have to work a little harder at it. And, you know, they would, I work with a running coach, and she says something that she noted, and this is just her observation, is that vegetarians and vegans tend to have more injuries than her meat eaters do.
Interesting. Okay.
And so that could be some of the nutrients that are just a little bit harder to get. From, you know, the iron, when we eat, well, I'll just use iron as an example. When we eat certain nutrients that are found in animal form, they are more absorbable by the body. So like iron is an example of that. Heme iron, which is found in animals, is very easily absorbed by the body. Non-heme, which we find in plants like beans, for instance, which are great sources of iron, but they're not as easily absorbable by the body. So as someone who eats a lot of plants and only salmon, but I don't eat a lot of other meats, I do supplement with iron because I tend to have lower iron levels. And if I ate meat, I probably wouldn't have to supplement with iron.
Right. So good point. Let's talk about the supplements. Boy, you talk about a billion-dollar industry.
Yes.
Holy cow, you just go into any grocery store and now they have a whole section of the store that's all of the supplements, all the supplements. Mm-hmm. I, for many years, have taken Juice Plus.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, I sometimes wonder, am I doing this because it sounds good? Is it really helping me? I'm not asking you to address that particular product, mm-hmm. but in general, what is your take on supplements? Is it overdone, or for the most part, they really can be helpful?
It's overdone for sure.
Okay.
But, and some of the big research studies show that like these, especially called the multivitamins of the world, when we look at people who take multivitamins, did they live longer or did they have less chronic disease? And that's usually never the case. So we don't really see positive health outcomes from taking these things. Now, supplements are that. They are made to supplement the diet. So I just use my iron example. I also, for most of my clients, recommend a vitamin D. It's very hard to get vitamin D, adequate levels of vitamin D from food. And we're all trying to be safe in the sun. And when you put sunscreen on your skin, that blocks 99.9% of vitamin D from your being able to utilize vitamin D. So a lot of people are low in vitamin D, and I always encourage them to ask their health provider to, you know, add vitamin D to the labs to see what it is. But I mean, most people need vitamin D. And if you're not eating a fish, like fatty fish twice a week, I usually recommend people to take an omega-3 because there's a lot of power around omega-3s and anti-inflammatory conditions like heart health, eye health, brain health. That's very well evidenced. So those are the two that I think are most people can probably take and benefit from. Mm-hmm. But yes, I think that there's a lot of shiny, exciting things around supplements that we're probably spending too much money, and including me. I fall prey to those just like everybody else.
Well, when I see something like brain health and memory, I'm like,
totally.
I'm a sucker
Why
for
not?
That stuff. I'm like, and I look at it and go, yeah, I don't think so. Let's separate when it comes to supplements, genders, men and women.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about women first. Are there certain things that women need to be more cognizant of than men in terms of what they should be taking, and that may mean a supplement?
Yeah.
It's
going to depend upon age. You know, it's good because a woman who still has her cycle is going to be more at risk of low iron compared to a woman who's in menopause,
mm-hmm.
right? It also depends upon, like, I mean, women tend to be more restrictive with their diets. So sometimes they might be less likely to meet some of the nutrient needs. A popular one that many people tend to benefit from is magnesium. Magnesium has been like a calming type of nutrient. And some say that the magnesium in our food isn't what it used to be. Magnesium is also really helpful for like regularity. So if anyone's suffering with constipation, taking a magnesium supplement, magnesium citrate to be example, there's lots of different forms of supplements too, right? So it's like, you don't just go and take magnesium. You got to figure out which form am I taking to match what I'm trying to accomplish with my goals. So yeah, I mean, and men most of the time don't need iron, right?
Right.
Most men and women both would need vitamin D. Most men and women both would benefit from an omega-3. So those would be some of the major differences. Like if you looked at a a multivitamin for men or a multivitamin for women. Also, depending upon childbearing age, like folate is going to be one because that's very important for neural tube development in a growing baby. So they're going to need to make sure that they've got enough folate and a supplement for women that men wouldn't necessarily need.
Yeah, you bring up a good
as
point.
Much.
Yes, right. So you bring up a good point with women go through various physical changes as they get older, more than men, as you mentioned. So with men, is it as big of a, is there anything that you would say is something that a man, as he gets older, they might want to be more cognizant of with a supplement that maybe is not as important to women? Does that even exist?
I mean, the men's supplements category would certainly say so, right? They would have things to say about that, whether it's creatinine for muscle mass,
yeah.
Right? That sort of thing, whether it's nitric oxide to help with blood delivery, you know, to be able to get in a workout, the best kind of workout, so the oxygen is going to the muscles like it should.
So it's that manly testosterone
comes a little bit back to that. That's mostly what I've seen. But also, I mean, men are, you know, just, I mean, they're not as likely to have osteoporosis or osteopenia, but those bone building nutrients, calcium and vitamin D, are also still important for men.
Mm-hmm.
So those are nutrients that I would be, you know, just looking at the diet with. But most people, as long as they're eating adequate calories, have the ability to be able to get most nutrients from the diet.
Mm-hmm. How about whether men or women, people like me, who, according to their spouse, exercises too much, but that's a personal issue.
We don't get into that.
Yes. But seriously, someone who just bikes, runs, swims, goes to the gym. My average is probably 7 to 10 hours a week when
that's
I'm
great.
Not even training. When I'm training for something, it might be 12 to 15 hours. Most of that is cardio.
Mm-hmm.
Someone like me, what are the most important things to keep in mind that I need to be flooding my body with?
Yeah.
The thing I always hear is carbohydrates, sugars,
mm-hmm.
right? I'm not a professional. I really don't even know what that is, frankly,
okay.
and why that's important.
Mm-hmm. I would start off with, if we're just talking about you and some active people like you, it's also meal patterns. Sometimes I will see, and I do feel like I see this more in men than women, they will go throughout the day with little intake, and then the majority of the intake comes at 6 p.m. or beyond.
Mm.
And so someone who is requiring lots of calories and energy to support the physical adaptations that you're asking of your body to do, if you really want to reap those rewards, you need to be eating every 3 hours. Right? So 6 and 9 and 12 and 3 and 6 and 9, maybe even, like, there's a big push for time restricted eating, not eating too late at night. For some people, having that pre-bedtime snack that contains carbohydrate and protein, I'll just use yogurt as an example, that's a really great thing to help with muscle mass while sleeping.
I am so glad you said that. Is the Simons household. My wife, you're watching this right now, but she jokes, it's like, oh, is that your second or third dinner? Because I feel it. It's not that I'm just, you know, going through the refrigerator just because I'm bored.
Mm-hmm.
I actually start to get hungry again at 8 or 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
I may have had a good dinner,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think I'm going to make it to breakfast the next day.
Right.
So I will forage through to try to find something at 8 or 9. And you're saying, no, that could be a real thing.
It's great for muscle and bone health.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Now, that's not right for everyone. Like,
right.
if we are talking to the person who's only exercising, you know, a couple hours a week, and they're trying to maybe reduce body fat, you know, then not eating right before bed, you know, and I'm not even saying you eat right before bed. I'm just saying, you know, a couple hours before
bed.
You have your nighttime snack. It's really not good to eat right before bed because our body is trying to settle into sleep.
Yes.
It's not wanting to digest food. So it is a good habit not to eat a couple of hours before bedtime if possible. But yeah, so then going back to the athlete's diet or the active person's diet, we are talking about a carbohydrate-rich diet. So that when we were talking about the fiber-rich foods, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, those are carbohydrates. Beans are a great carbohydrate. And then we have, you know, the fun carbohydrates, right? So the sweets and the sports drinks. And so those sorts of things. And I think for those who are active, you have wiggle room to be able to have those things. And, you know, I am a big believer that we should not deprive. And if we deprive, we end up overdoing it later, mm-hmm. in some form or fashion. So building in those fun foods but building them in the right amount that supports you and your goals.
You had mentioned sleep. Mm-hmm. Address that. What are some good foods to either have or avoid? The obvious ones, you're not going to have caffeine. You don't want to drink a six-pack of beer because you won't have good sleep there. But outside of that, are there foods that are known to enhance sleep?
So carbohydrates, you know, so when I talked about yogurt, well, what do you have before? What are some of the things that you'll have as your second dinner? I'll use an example.
It depends. I'll go in and sometimes I'll see a big thing of a three-bean salad that my wife bought at Dierbergs or Schnucks, and I'll have that. Sometimes we have a couple of pieces of pizza left over from dinner, and I'll just have that. So honestly, Jen, It's a variety. Yes.
Well, I like the bean thing before, you know, not like right before bed. You know, wake yourself up tooting in the middle of the night. Well,
you said it, not me.
Dietitians have no problem talking about that.
Well, you talked about fecal matter before, so hey, we're
really
putting it all out there.
It's an important piece of our health to understand all of that.
Yes.
But anyway, that was a good carb protein combination. And it was a nice, even, steady flow of energy, right? So what we're always trying to avoid is just like a blood sugar spike and a drop. Mm. And when we only eat carbohydrates just totally by itself, that will happen. So like if someone is a banana lover and they just had a banana, you might get a little bit of a spike and a little bit of a drop. But if you had a banana with like a thing of almond butter or peanut butter on top of it, now I've got this like more even energy, more even blood sugar that occurs from the combination of the carbohydrate and a little bit of fat. But you don't want to eat a whole lot of fat before bed. So the pizza might not be as healthy of a choice because it's higher in fat, which is going to take, your body has to work harder at digesting that. So that might interfere with your quality of sleep. So we're looking for easily digestible foods. So fruits with like a little bit of fat, like I said, or your bean salad, or yogurt. I just think yogurt, small smoothie. A bowl of cereal is a really common one, you know, for people just to have a healthy bowl of cereal. By healthy, I mean it has some fiber in it. It's not just like Fruit Loops, you know, you got a little fiber, a little bit of milk. And milk in particular has got casein, right? So that's a slow digesting protein. And that's going to be really helpful during sleep for muscles.
Well, you just mentioned a couple of things that I do like to consume. And so, folks, I am about to have you all enter into the Dave Simons world of eating. And we're going to put up on the screen, and Jen, you can be, I know you'll be as honest as you need to be with my eating habits the last couple of days. Now, let me just give the disclaimer. This is just the last 2 days. This isn't necessarily indicative of an everyday thing. I just thought what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring in, and we'll put it on the screen here in a second, what I have eaten the last 2 days, just as an example. And I know what you do in terms of, you can't go too deep in an analysis because obviously if I'm a client, we're going to ask a lot more questions. But 30,000 foot view this thing, what I'm about to show you. So it's now up on the screen. Mm-hmm. And so you can see day one, let's call that Saturday. Mm-hmm. And you can see you talked about a bowl of cereal. And I always put in my cereal, I'll add blueberries and blackberries to it. That's a thing. Yep. One thing I didn't put in there is I'll also add chia seeds on there.
Oh, okay.
Always. And then it just so happened this Saturday, then I went out and did open water swimming. I did a 40-minute swim, and I was kind of hungry. So I got home, had the Greek yogurt, and it's a berries thing in there. Then for lunch, I love Mexican stuff. Just happened to be Qdoba, free advertising, but I'll go to Chipotle or anything like that. Mm-hmm. You can see what I have there. The mid-afternoon snack, love hummus. Mm. Oh, do I eat a lot of hummus. Mm. That's probably okay. I don't know about the tortilla chips. I'm sure you would say carrots or celery with that. We'll get to that in a second. And then, my wife and I had the thin crust pizza. She got the veggie. I will give her credit. I did the full meat thing. And like I told you before, hey, before bed, I had to get that last piece of pizza.
Yes.
Now, day two. So we'll call this Sunday.
Okay.
Some of you may look at it and go, oh, Dave, really? Pop-Tarts? Yeah, but there's a purpose to it, all right? As you'll see there on the screen, I then went out and ran 8 miles up at Creve Coeur Park on Sunday. And during the run, I stopped halfway through, had a goo, electrolyte drink. Mid-morning, went over to Smoothie King, another free advertising there. Got the Gladiator with the banana and almond butter. You can see lunch. I love pasta, I admit. You talk about carbs, I eat a lot of pasta. More hummus. there's my mid-afternoon snack. Hey, we talked about the three bean salad and then the dinner. Also love that chicken tortilla soup, and I eat quite a bit of that. Had some grapes as a side. And then, yeah, there it is at the end. Yep, my ice cream. And it doesn't, again, free advertising for Silky Freeze, but honestly, it doesn't. When someone goes, where do you like to go for ice cream? I just say, yes.
Anywhere, yes.
Doesn't matter.
Yes.
It could be, I have the sweet too. So,
I do too.
Again, 30,000 foot view this thing. What do you think overall? What could I maybe have had more of the last two days? What am I overdoing?
Well, okay, so one of the things that I do with clients, I say, what was it like journaling? What was it like writing everything down for you?
At times it was, I almost knowing that I was going to do this with you, I didn't want to put some of it down.
Okay.
I didn't want to maybe put the chips with the, and I didn't know if I wanted to put the pizza before bed. I thought, no, I got to be 100% honest.
Yeah.
So in answer to your question, it was okay for the most part, except I thought I'm being a little more vulnerable than I think I want to be here. That was the thought that I had.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have every client do this. It always is helpful for me to see dietary patterns, but I think that what journaling does is it increases our awareness of what we do, because it really is hard to remember what I ate yesterday.
Yes.
Like I couldn't tell you that right now on the spot. And the accountability, right? So if you set a goal towards wanting to eat more carbohydrates to fuel your training, knowing you're looking at it and or someone else is even looking at it can be helpful, but it's not something that I want for clients to have to do forever. It's a little tool in their toolbox that we pull out and we occasionally experiment with.
So
I always like to say, all right, for someone who's active, you're not only eating for what you did today, you're eating for what you did tomorrow, you're going to do tomorrow. And you had an 8-mile run, which is not insignificant. I mean, how long did that take you, not to make you like,
I was probably running, you know, that's my longer pace, which is probably 9:15 to 9:30 pace.
Okay.
I do different runs, you know, it's not an interval type hard run, just a nice, easy jog. It probably took me about an hour, about 75 minutes, about an hour 15.
So, you know, at some point, if it continued to get longer, right, then you need to probably increase your carbohydrates the day before. And the fat content of the day before would have been slightly higher. And so I would have dialed down the fat a little bit and increased the good carbohydrates. So where would we decrease the fat, do you think, in this day that you wrote down?
Oh, man, decrease that. Well, I guess it depends on the kind of pizza, but you got all that cheese and the crust and all that. I probably could have had something better for that.
Okay, so yeah, you might have swapped out some, maybe a little, like one serving of meat, like just sausage and mushrooms. just kidding.
You went and said it.
or to have like a salad or something with the pizza.
Sure.
My mom used to always make us do that. Before Domino's would arrive, we'd have to eat our salad before that.
No, that's a good idea because that takes away maybe some of the hunger.
Well,
right?
Yes. And we just got it all in. That doesn't really add a ton of carbs there. But here we could have had some beans and chicken maybe instead of the brisket, because you had two servings of kind of like the higher fat meats here.
Good point. I should have probably added in that burrito, I did have white rice and black beans.
Okay, good. So now that tells me you actually had more carbohydrate than this is.
Yes, I'm glad you asked about that.
So it's good for the dietitian or whoever's looking at this to just keep asking more questions about, like, even the serving size. I mean, I love people to eat a really big breakfast. Now, you were about ready to go out for a swim, so this is perfect.
I probably did two cups of cereal.
Yeah. So this was great. I mean, I love it when people choose higher fiber and they've got some protein in their breakfast. You know, if you were going to go do some strength training or you didn't have a workout here, we could have added maybe a little bit more protein in the first meal. What we're looking for, I don't know if we want to get into grams here on this podcast.
No,
but
please.
So if you take your weight and you cut it in two, or 2.2 is kilograms, right? So if we put your weight into kilograms and we multiplied that number times 0.4, that would tell us how much protein we're trying to get at each meal.
Yeah, I've seen those formulas.
So this would probably be a little shy of that, a little low. Your number might come out to be around 28 grams, 30 grams of protein. And when we start with protein in the morning, that really helps to set hunger and fullness hormones the rest of the day. So for people who complain about really being hungry all the time, if they look at their morning meal and add some more protein, they might find that that helps. It also helps because you have been fasting overnight, and when you wake up, your muscles are at their highest point of breakdown. So I can stop the muscles from breaking down by giving them a good dose of protein in the morning.
Interesting.
So like plain Greek yogurt or Greek yogurt in general is a really good source. You know, eggs are good sources. Having a smoothie with a little protein powder are all wonderful ways to get in, get that protein in. So that's just one thing to mention. I mean, the tortilla chips and hummus, I don't have, you know, you could add an apple with that just to get in some more carbohydrate because you had your 8-mile run the next day.
Yeah.
It all comes down to the portion, right? It's like, did I have tortilla chips or did I have tortilla chips, you know? I never want to take anything away from someone, but it's just like, all right, put your tortilla chips on a plate, maybe have some snap peas or red bell peppers or something else with your hummus, and then have your hummus. And now that's a more satiating, higher fiber snack. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think you do great. I mean, lots of different plants.
B plus maybe?
Yeah. Yes. I don't do nutritional analysis in my brain, so I don't know how many grams of fiber was.
That's what we're saying. This has got to be very above level here because I could show you a full week, but I thought that'd be interesting. I'll just kind of write down and that's the point, really. We get back to kind of what I said at the beginning of the podcast in my intro, in that I don't think that we have to be so regimented. Like I'm going to eat this and I'm going to eat this and no, I don't even want to look at that cookie. Nope. Not going to do it. That's not what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
And I'm going to eat this and eat this. Now, look, if that drives you and you're happy doing it, knock yourself out. Mm-hmm. But if it's really hard to get through because I'm not having any fun.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a difficult diet. It might be working. I might be seeing results. I think isn't it more lifestyle holistic that we can still occasionally have our cheat meal and we don't have to be quite as regimented if overall we're still eating relatively healthy with a little bit of exercise.
Yes.
Right?
I don't like the word cheat meal because then I just feel like that sets us up for every other meal. It must just be horrible because I have to cheat in order to, you know, so I think it's really important. I want myself, I want my family, I want my clients, every meal they sit down to, I want it to be something they look forward to eating. And if it's not, then we need to refigure it out because food is joy. And so we want to be able to enjoy the meals that we're eating. And I think that over time, you know, they do MRIs and they look at like how brains light up. And when people adopt healthier eating habits, you know, the French fries that used to light up their brain, which would still light up my brain. But like, you know, if they see a really yummy broccoli salad or something, like you can change the way your brain responds to food. Their brains light up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So it's possible for us to find joy in all of the nourishing, healthy foods that are out there. But we have to practice a little bit with them and we need to do things that are fairly easy for us to do. And a restrictive mindset just really backfires most of the time for most people. I mean, I get that. I got a client last week who really, he eats the same thing a lot. And so I was just trying to work within his template. All right. So instead of blueberries every single day, maybe next week it's blackberries for that food, right? So subtle shifts, because we do get decision fatigue. I get tired of having to think of what are we going to have for dinner?
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of my clients and I work on meal planning together. Like, okay, so Mondays is always going to be some kind of meatless meal. Sundays is salmon Sundays, you know, so I just do some kind of different dish with salmon. So we sort of give ourselves some framework to work within so we don't have to like think about what we're going to eat every single meal three or five times a day.
Boy, you know? Isn't that the truth? You're getting a lot of amens right now. And that includes the Simons household. I wish I could be more helpful to my wife because she asks me all the time, what do you want tonight?
Yes.
I don't know. I start to think of all these things that I would eat. I'm of no help. And I'm, like I said, I'm really easy. It's just the mushrooms and the mayonnaise. If you avoid that,
I'll
eat anything.
You're not a picky eater, no.
But it gets to your point. Would you recommend that maybe people, when they do the grocery shopping, that they already have things planned out in advance to say, okay, I am shopping. I'm just not going to go up and down the aisles. Oh, that looks good. That looks good. And then, hey, what are we going to eat tonight? No, I'm going to have this planned out for the week. And then I will be more intentional when I go down the grocery store aisles.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, there's some people, I mean, I'm in awe by the people who literally know Monday it's this, and then they actually like portion it out and they get it ready. Like, I don't go that far, but I have a couple of ideas of what we're going to have for the week, and I make the grocery list based upon that. And then I call what are our like easy button meals. So those are meals that I know I can get together pretty quickly as long as I have the ingredients on hand. So that might be like baked bean burritos, or it might be eggs for breakfast. I mean, eggs for dinner, you know, just breakfast for dinner, that sort of thing.
I like that stuff.
You know, too. The Applegate turkey burgers that I can just throw on the grill really quickly for everybody, and then air fry some sweet potato fries with a veg, right? So just having those and having a family come up with a list. What are our top 10 really easy meals that I can, that the parent, whoever it is, the adult can throw on the table and get it ready? And so you kind of keep a few of those meals on your list. And then I always have things in the freezer, you know, freezer items that if, you know, last minute, I can just bring it out of the freezer and it's ready. So, yeah, I think you need a plan that works for you and your family, but absolutely sitting down for as little as like 15 or 20 minutes. And I tend to do that on Fridays when I sit down to lunch. I think about, okay, what are we going to have for the next week? And then I use Instacart. So then I populate it and I have all the groceries delivered on Saturday. And then on Sunday, I do a little bit of the meal prep. So I also think it's important not to think about what you're going to eat, go to the grocery store, get everything ready all on the same day. That's so much. That's so overwhelming. So I think it's easier to break it up into bite-sized pieces.
I want to just for you to plug your book real quick, because you had mentioned it earlier, Mediterranean.
The Mediterranean Table Cookbook.
They can find it on Amazon?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, awesome.
Yes,
awesome.
Yeah, there's a lot of good Mediterranean cookbooks. And I mean, the book is very good. It's got beautiful recipes. It's also got a lot of education in there about the Mediterranean diet. There's another really good one by Serena Ball called the 30-minute Mediterranean Meals. So a bit more easy peasy kind of Mediterranean dishes.
You know, one of the things I said in my own industry, if I were king for a day, if I was dictator of the financial services industry, these are the things that I would change. I would eliminate this. I would make sure that advisors got licensed in this, and I would think this is a better world now for all the mom and pop investors out there. You are queen for a day in your industry. You are dictator. So in the world of nutrition and that entire food, and you can make this as big as you want. Tell me some things that you would want to see incorporated into the food industry, into how people read about this, the knowledge of it. I'll let you take that, explore with it how you will.
You should have given me this question ahead of time.
Oh, because so you have a ton probably, right?
I would start with marketing. I would start with food marketing, because kids see all their favorite cartoons on all the foods that are not carrots, right? I mean, we are starting to see, you know, I don't know what it was on the banana sticker the other day, right? But I would spend all of the money marketing on these foods that are fruits and vegetables and natural things that we can find in the store, just to give kids, like, you know, the same attention that they get on these ultra processed foods that are out there. Mm-hmm. And the Oreos, you know, I mean, I bought Oreos at Target. The Mario Kart new movie or whatever was all over it, right? And that caught my eye. And so I would change that. I would also change the money that goes towards the dieting industry.
That would be for me.
Yes. And stop putting that into that. And I would put it more into brain health and microbiome health and all of the areas that are so important and crucial to the well-being of people, not just their meat suit, right? I want to focus on the mental health piece. Can we talk more about what makes me feel more mentally stable? Because we know that there's a huge issue with depression and anxiety, and the death, what's the word I'm looking for? When people die, what's that age? The age range of where we die is, it used to be like 80, and now it's, you know, in the 70s, it's gone down. So we're living.
Oh, the actuarial tables of when we actually, that's right. Now, some of that has to do, unfortunately, tragically, with opioid use of young people, suicides.
But that goes back to mental health.
That's exactly right, yeah.
So some of that is, all right, if we're spending so much time in social media and we're spending all these, you know, in places, but we're also seeing a bunch of, you know, people are staying at home and they're eating unhealthy foods and they're not getting outside and they're not moving their bodies and they're not getting in nature. And all of that, I think, leads to kids just not feeling good about themselves and their own bodies. Mm-hmm. So, so that's...
Well, I'll add a couple things. This gets to where you, you'd have to be supernatural to do this, but let's fantasize where we'd say, okay, cake and ice cream, zero calories. Mushrooms, 3,000 calories per mushroom. So that's one thing. I don't know, why are the things that we love have to be the worst for us? That's a
I disagree with that, though. The things that I love are wonderful.
But see, you have a lifestyle of that, and I think part of it, well, it gets back to what you've programmed yourself to. I think for a lot of people, they would say, no, I eat broccoli because I know it's healthy, but I don't necessarily enjoy it. Get me up there to Ted Drew's, and I'll pull my car up and live there all night long.
So maybe what you're saying is the activity that we get in our brains when we eat certain foods, you wish you could change that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That would.
We want the foods that are good for us to be good, like to also taste good. And
bingo. That's what I guess I'm getting at.
And I think that's also how we prepare those things. I mean, I have lots of clients who came in and they remember their experience with asparagus was like canned asparagus. Like, I can't think of anything more disgusting.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But when you grill asparagus with balsamic and, you know, a little brown sugar and sesame oil, like, that's a whole different animal. So it's, you know, it's also reteaching ourselves that you can add fat, you can add sugar, you can add things to plants or to healthier foods to make them taste good. And then you're palate starts to get adjusted. And then if you need to dial some of that stuff down, you certainly can, but you're still getting all the nutrients, even if you add a little butter and salt and sugar.
You know, you had mentioned the asparagus. It reminds me of growing up as a kid and why I didn't care for peaches, because we would get the Del Monte in the can.
Yes.
Peaches, all the sugary syrup, and they were okay. It's not like I disliked them.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't do much for me. So as I get older, I'm like, yeah, I'm not a big peach fan. I start buying real fresh peaches and it's like crack to me. I mean, there's nothing better than going to these markets, Kirkwood Market or wherever.
Totally.
And buying these fresh fruits and you get a good peach. Is there anything better than
that? No. And let me say one more thing. I want to advocate again for all the fruits and vegetables and all that, you know, and not just fruits and vegetables, but healthy eating patterns, right? If we pay attention very closely to how we feel after we eat certain things, you'll notice a difference, right? Mm-hmm. Like if I have ice cream at 3 o'clock for a snack, which we did have yesterday, it was delicious.
Of course it was.
But I, after like an hour or two later, I kind of felt a little shaky. I didn't feel the same as if I would have had my bowl of popcorn and cashew nuts and whatever snacks I've been enjoying lately, you know? And if I had a cheeseburger and French fries, it would feel different than if I had the salmon and the, you know, baked potato and something else, you know? So when we pay attention truly to how we feel, our energy, how our body is functioning, you tend to crave those combinations of foods that really leave you feeling the best version of yourself.
That is so true. And the opposite too, when you get away from the junk stuff, I notice that I don't eat a lot of traditional old fashioned, go to the drive through and get a cheeseburger. No knock against the kinds of places I grew up eating.
Right.
But when I occasionally might stop and get one because I'm on the road and I have no other choice, I don't feel particularly great an hour or two later. Yes. And maybe it doesn't sit well in my stomach. That's not how it used to be when I was a kid or younger, but I got away from it. And then when I throw that stuff in my body, the body's like, yeah, we're kind of rejecting it a little bit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think you're right. I mean, someone who has the patterns where they are eating fast food most of the day, they're not going to notice that because they haven't had the ability to see what it's, they haven't played around with the ability to see what it's like to have these other combinations of foods. But as we move our dietary patterns in a way that is good for us, I think we'll be rewarded by how we feel.
Mm-hmm.
I know
mm-hmm.
we will be.
Yeah. So I want to bring in my passion of exercise into this. I know you deal with athletes.
Mm-hmm.
I had started off this podcast by talking about you could have two extremes, right?
Mm-hmm.
You could have the person who is so regimented, they're really good at putting all the right stuff in their body, and you would look at them and go, A+. But they don't do any exercise at all.
Mm-hmm.
To this person over here who is, let's say, even a professional athlete, but works out all the time and can pretty much eat anything they want, and they do, and it's not necessarily even healthy.
Mm-hmm.
I think we would both agree the answer is somewhere in the middle.
Yes.
Is nutrition, for the most part, more important than exercise? Where does exercise play into the equation of what you do for a living?
So I would argue that if you only could choose one and you could only focus on one area, that yes, focusing on having the high quality diet would be more of a powerful impact. But exercise, I mean, exercise does so much. Exercise helps our mental health. Exercise helps our heart health. Exercise helps how our hormones work and insulin sensitivity, right? So when I eat something with carbohydrate, if I'm someone who exercises, I handle that carbohydrate pretty well. Mm-hmm. But if I'm completely sedentary and I eat the same amount of carbohydrate that the athlete eats, I don't get that same blood sugar response, right? I get more spikes and drops, and I don't have that same kind of control. It's, my insulin sensitivity is less, it doesn't work as well. So exercise also is really important for muscle and bone health. And so, you know, different types of exercises too, right? Whether it's walking and a combination of that with some strength training, or yoga and swimming. I mean, we need exercise to be our healthiest selves, for
mm-hmm.
sure.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think exercise is, I'm obviously a huge believer too. I work with athletes. I'm
yes.
active myself.
Mm-hmm.
And it has changed for me over time. I mean, if I'm being very honest, college-aged years, I used exercise in a controlling way. And it controlled how I knew it felt, made me feel better, but it also made me controlling body composition, just controlling life, really. It was kind of in that role for me. And now exercise has become more of, I know it allows me to be more creative. It allows me to just feel, I'm my best version of myself when I'm out for a run. I'm cheering myself
yes.
on, and I come back with all this good stuff, and it's a stress manager for me, and it's not as important. It's not about the physical benefits as much as it really is more of the mental
mm-hmm.
health benefits as much. But when you introduced the topic in the very beginning, one word that you said was should. And I think we want to always be very careful about feeling that way. I want to be pulled towards what I want to do. I don't want to feel like I have to push myself towards what I do. And when people connect with what they enjoy about something, whether it's food or movement or a mindfulness activity, then we're so much more likely to stick with it. So I really want to encourage people to not necessarily do what they feel like they should do. I want them to connect with what feels right for them.
Right.
And then they will find what's best for them.
You are obviously very passionate about this. That's why you're here, because you're also very knowledgeable and have a lot of experience. I'm always intrigued by decisions that people make when they're young, high school, college, their career path. Is this something that you always wanted to get into for as long as you could remember? Why did you get into this field? What drove you to even go down this route to begin with?
So I did love cooking at a very early age. I loved putting the hot sauce with the cocoa powder, with the salt, and trying to make my sister eat all the random combinations of things that I put together.
She was your guinea pig.
My younger sister, of course.
Yes.
She will attest to that. And my mom and dad both worked. And so when I would come home from school, my mom was always teaching piano lessons. She's a musician. And sometimes she would have food ready for us to eat, but sometimes it was a Swanson frozen meal. And I kind of got tired of those. So I taught myself how to cook at a very early age out of just, I don't really want another turkey gravy, frozen pea, cranberry sauce meal, mom. So I did learn how to cook. And then I also was really involved in sport. I was a gymnast. Then I moved into cheerleading and all those sorts of things. So I kind of, you know, I was interested in health. I had all the health magazines. And then when I was a junior in high school, my father had found a 90% blocked artery, artery, and had a quadruple bypass surgery. And he was only 52 years old. Mm. So that was really scary. You know, That was very momentous for me at that time to see my dad, who's the strongest person in your life, in the hospital bed with all the wires connected to him when he's 52 years old. So I learned at an early age that I had a similar genetic makeup as my dad. He's the youngest of 10, and every single one of his brothers have passed away from heart disease.
Really? You talk about genetics. Wow.
Yes. And so when I came to my high school guidance counselor, I was like, well, I really love to cook. I'm pretty good at science. And I'm interested in a lot of health stuff. She was like, well, there is this role called a dietitian, which I kind of found. I mean, that was like 1995, you know, and the registered dietitian's name was definitely not as it is today. And so she told me about the career path. And so I was like, that's definitely what I want to do. And so I've never looked back. I've always been incredibly happy with my choice. And
that's unusual, you know. People go through different careers, different choices, but you've been on that same path the whole time.
Well, and the cool thing about dietetics is that you can do so much under the umbrella. Mm. You know, I mean, I've worked in, you know, endocrinology, and I've done research, and I've taught at St. Louis University, and I've, you know, now own my own business. And even with the own business, we do everything from gut health to eating disorders to sports nutrition to heart health. So it's, you kind of can't get bored. And the research is always evolving and changing, and it's just fun to stay on top of that.
Yeah, I was going to say, just as you're talking, that's exactly the question that came to my mind is, what you know today is not what you could have known back in 95. And that's not just because of experience and you continue to read. That's because the information that we get constantly changes.
Yes.
Right? And more data comes out, and more scientific research comes out. Is there anything... And we'll ask you to do some self-examination professionally here. Is there anything that you thought pretty sure of 20, 25 years ago that you look today and go, yeah, I was kind of wrong about that? Does anything jump out at that? Or at least maybe you've changed it a little bit.
Yeah, definitely my approach to helping people with weight loss has changed.
Is that right? How so?
You know, I think it was like, oh, this calories, calorie out thing. And that is part of it. But as we talked about in the very beginning, it is so much more complex than that. And even when we talk about similar foods, like if I was, you know, had 100 calories of Twizzlers and 100 calories of, well, I'm trying not to use an extreme, we'll say potatoes, right? They're both carbohydrates. But when those nutrients come into the body, because the potatoes have these different antioxidants in there and vitamins and minerals and different fibers, they interact differently with a microbiome, right? So 100 calories is not just 100 calories. It's so much more about the quality of the diet than it is just about calories. I mean, someone could be eating a lot more calories, but the quality is better, right? And they're losing more weight than someone who's eating a low-calorie diet that's, you know, not high quality. So, and then the emotional pieces of that, you know, like you said, also, I wear a counseling hat, so it's a respectful conversation, and I'm honored to get to have people be vulnerable with me about their relationship with food. And so really working on that piece about it, because we don't, you know, it's not just this one thing. It's how I sleep. It's how I manage stress. It's how I move my body. It's all of those things. And sometimes I might spend a whole session talking to someone about just routines and sleep, because that makes a difference in their body composition goals. So I'm done with, you know, counting the calories exactly and, you know, this for that. I mean, that's helpful. And we still do some of that, but I spend so much more time in other areas.
That's interesting. There is a lot of shame, isn't there, with people who know they're overweight and they struggle with it. It can be internal. It's quiet. They may not make a big deal out of it, but because of the society that we're in. So that's where the counseling comes in a little bit, right? Where you have to kind of dig into that a little bit. And I think we've done better in today's society not being prejudicial against that, because I think, I'll just speak for me personally, and I'm not proud of this, but in years past, when I was younger and I was active, and still am, but really when I was a younger man, I was exercising, and I would look at somebody walking down the street, 300 pounds. And I'd say, really? Really? Now, what I've learned is, yeah, maybe that's not a big deal to them and I don't care. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about that person might have some things going on in life that I know nothing about. There's a combination of genetics. There's a combination of trauma. Maybe it's childhood trauma. Now, I don't mean to be all touchy-feely and all that, but one of the things that I've learned is to be more open-minded and accepting that I don't know someone's full story. And maybe they have been trying so hard and they've done so many diets and maybe it's worked and I just happen to be seeing them when they're back on up here, because you know a lot of people, it's very common for people to go through those cycles of putting weight on, losing weight. I am blessed. I'm lucky. I've never had that. I'm 61. I've never had a weight issue at all. So I can't with any kind of expertise speak into that. Mm-hmm. You can. Take that entire little thing that I just said and make it into a question, if you will. But I'd like you to address a little bit of the stigma that we still have in this society and how you, with your counseling hat, have to kind of dig into stuff that they might be battling with mm-hmm. that we don't know anything about.
Well, first and foremost, you talked about trauma. And I think there's not one human on earth who hasn't experienced either little T trauma or big T trauma. And those are just kind of the extremes of trauma that one might experience in life and how their body or their actions change after experiencing that trauma. And it's unfortunate because with obesity, it's you know, they can't hide. Whereas someone who has trauma and now they're an alcoholic, you can hide that.
Good point.
Right? We have many dysfunctional ways of coping with the world. And a lot of those ways of coping with the world aren't for the world to judge because it's not so visible. So I think our world is doing we have a lot of work to do, but I think that we're doing better at recognizing that judging is definitely not helpful.
Right.
And that, you know, and also the same person that you see walking down the street could be 100% perfectly content and peaceful in their body. And a 130-pound person walking right behind them could be miserable with their body because they think they have 5 pounds left to lose.
Mm, that is so true. And maybe they're not even that healthy because they smoke 3 packs of cigarettes a day.
Yeah.
Right?
So part of it too is recognizing and we're throwing out measurements. We're learning to like ignore body mass index and some of these measurements that just really aren't helpful because we do know at various levels of body type and size, you can have wonderfully healthy metrics and labs, right? So it's not always, we just think, oh, the more weight, the worse off. And that's not always true, you know? So I think that we're learning more about those things. And we also have to recognize what we are to blame as a society for giving more money to pharmaceutical companies and giving more money to big food companies that are, you know, there's so much to share the blame for our obesogenic environment that mm-hmm. we have to fight against. And then add trauma on top of that when food is so accessible and then they eat something and I feel better. That's a learned response. That's a really hard thing to untangle. So it's so much. And I think that if people want to make those changes, then we do the deep work that it takes, but it all comes back to the same thing, regardless of body size. We have, because there's a lot of people who are too thin that are very unhappy too.
Right.
So, you know, I think it's about finding that healthy relationship with self, with food, and making it an approach that's so sustainable for them. Because if someone feels like I have to turn everything upside down in order to be what I think I should be or what society is telling me to be, that's not going to work. That's too big of a hill to conquer.
You mentioned BMI, body mass index.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm obese.
Right, exactly. It's
because
silly.
As people can tell, I'm not a naturally thin, like I'm not that skinny rail runner.
Mm-hmm.
Parts of, yeah, there are times like, man, I could run even faster if I genetically was built that way, but I'm not.
Yeah, that's right.
And I also go to the gym, and so I've got, my body fat is low, mm-hmm. but my actual overall weight is on the high side for my 5'10 frame.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the big joke around my office, because I come back, because we get tested for insurance purposes.
Oh,
we
right.
can get discounts
yeah.
and things. Yeah. It's not a big deal, but I come back and people in my office will go, well, are you still fat? And I'm like, yeah, I'm listed as obese. And as one of my colleagues years ago said, you are the fattest, skinniest person I know.
It's a terrible
metric.
And
I thought, that's probably a good way to put that. I don't think they use it as much anymore. I get the feeling that that's starting to like not be as important of an index anymore.
Yeah, yes, they are moving away from that, I think. But it's still used in criteria for pharmaceutical drugs, you know, the new weight loss drugs and things and that sort of information. So yeah, I mean, it's still being used by the medical community, but I think we're trying to move away from it.
Speaking of that, you just mentioned it. This is the newest thing. These weight loss drugs, they're huge. Mm-hmm. These pharmaceutical companies are standing to make billions of dollars. That's not necessarily any kind of knock of what they're trying to do. People are taking them. They're seeing results.
Yep.
Your thoughts on this new part of the industry now?
I think that they can play a role. I think they need to be used in the right audience. You know, they're not being used in the right audience all of the time. And, you know, there's doctors that are giving the medicines out to people who can afford them and not because they necessarily need them. And so they're the medicines as they are now, you have to continue taking them if you want the result. So it's not like you can take it and then whatever weight was lost will stay off. So, you know, it's financially expensive if you're not getting it by insurance. And it can cause side effects, you know, that some people don't stay on the medicines because of. And I think as long as we are complementing it with education and behavior change, that there's a positive role that can potentially be had from them. But I love it when I see people still come to see us while they're on the medication. Mm-hmm. Or I also have many clients who are like, well, my doctor told me I should be on it, but I don't want to be. So I just want to work on, I really want to work on my nutrition and exercise and all the things that go along with that. And I really respect that. So
you hit it though. You said compliment. That, see, my biggest problem has been, I hope this isn't the be-all, end-all for a lot of people to say, oh, well, this is the answer to all my prayers. I'm not changing anything else in my lifestyle, but I'm going to start taking this pill because I can afford it. You had mentioned the cost. That's been prohibitive for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to take this pill and everything is right with the world. And I kind of cringe at that.
That might lead them to want to make changes. Mm-hmm. And so I think that they will figure that out. I mean, if the bigger body is not responding in that way and their health is still seemingly on point, well, I don't know. But most people are going to notice some kind of metric that will be shared with them that maybe there's a need to change something, you know, whatever that is, whether it's moving more or changing a certain dietary habit. But I think we're trying to fly in the face of what we've been, you know, we've been in for so long, which is push the skinny, perfect person.
Right.
And people are tired of that. So we might have gone this other direction, but I think what I tend to see is people just celebrating their bodies and loving who they are, and I see nothing wrong with that ever. Mm-hmm. But I think if they personally decide that, yes, actually the body that I'm in is just not functioning as well, then it'll behoove them to make a change. I don't think anybody's aspiring to be, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't talk to many people that say, oh, I want to put on 50 pounds to be overweight. I don't really hear that.
I've seen a lot of these Hollywood actresses, and I'm like, wow, you got some guts, but good for you. Where let's say this was me this morning without makeup and without being airbrushed. You're like, oh, you yes, look like all the everyone else that I see.
Right.
You know, it's good for them though, right?
Yes. Yes. Good for them.
Yeah. Well, Jen McDaniel, thank you so much for
That's
your
awesome.
Time here. I've learned a ton. I really have. And I hope that a lot of our listeners and watchers and viewers have also learned a lot. Because you've been so kind, I want to like give some back to you by publicizing your company a little bit.
Great.
We're going to put it up on the screen right now.
Thank
but
you.
But if anyone does have follow-up questions or would like to reach out to you, let us know what your website is. And you also do a blog and you have some of your own podcasts, right?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yes. So if people are interested in our services, I mean, we have everything from what we talked about, the genetic testing, to working with our dietitians individually, to custom meal planning now. That's a whole new service that we added. We'll finally tell you exactly what to eat.
Mm-hmm.
You have to work with us on it, though. You don't just get a meal plan. You have to come alongside us and learn how to do it with us. But that's McDanielNutrition.com. And then the blog is also on McDanielNutrition.com. And then our podcast is called the Love You More podcast, where it's all about self-care, deep level self-care, not like the shiny, I got my new manicure self-care, but like the deeper stuff. So yes, that could be found on all the podcast places.
Well, Jen, thank you very much and appreciate your time. And we'll talk to you next time on the next Simon Says podcast. Take care.
Thank you so much for listening, and please forward the link to this podcast to friends, family, neighbors, even strangers. They'll thank you later. If you'd like more information on our wealth management team, just go to your search engine and type in Simons and Cordes, S-I-M-O-N-S and C-O-R-D-E-S, Simons and Cordes, and the website will be the first thing that pops up. I'll talk to you again soon on the next episode of the Simon Says podcast.